Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield, and tonight we are welcoming a very special guest into the centre circle to discuss their latest slash debut book with regards to the beautiful game. But as ever, before we introduce tonight's guest, I'd like to introduce my co-host, as one is missing. So we've only got one co-host tonight, and that man is Mr. Gary Thacker. Gary, how are you, sir?
I'm good, thanks, Stu. Looking forward to this, mate. The book's an absolute dream. I've read it. It took me about a week and a half to read it, and you know, if anybody takes longer than that, yeah, you really don't know anything about football, because it's a fantastic read. So we're looking forward to chatting with our special guest tonight about the book.
And it's funny. It's one of those books where, as I was reading it, I was like, about the research that has gone into this, and how much time has been spent just watching football is unreal, with the amount of detail that's gone into it. It's going to be great. It's going to be great. So tonight's special guest, where do I start? So tonight's special guest is probably one of my two best friends with regards to These Football Times. He is like a shadow of me, in that we are almost identical in the way we think, what we enjoy about the beautiful game, our opinions and thoughts. We almost have some telepathic link. He is a guy that I probably spend more time talking to than my own family, which, to be fair, my own family are actually quite happy about that. He's a guy who has the most incredible font of knowledge when it comes to football and the beautiful game, and this is borne out in the book, that is just a tiny part of the beautiful game, but shows the sheer depth of knowledge that this guy has. Our special guest, who's here tonight to talk about, like I say, his new book, which is A Tournament Frozen in Time, The Wonderful Randomness of the European Cup Winners' Cup, is Gary and I's good friend and normal co-host, Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, thank you for joining us.
This is a little bit weird, isn't it? This is with a heavy degree of nepotism involved as well. It's weird being on this side of the desk. If we had an actual desk in front of us,
I actually have a desk.
Guest chair, Stevie.
Yeah, in front of the on the wrong side of the metaphorical desk that we have between the three of us.
It's very. I was trying to think of writing an introduction, and I must have come up with about three or four. Then I thought, you know what? I'm just going to wait and see how it feels.
How it works now, yeah. Pans out.
And as it was, when I made the call, it just felt weird right from the start. So I just went with how it went. So Gary's right. Gary and I were lucky enough, incredibly lucky enough, that you sent us a copy to almost proofread, if you like, the finished article, which was obviously a real privilege that we've had a chance to read it before it's out, because the book isn't actually out till, I want to say, Monday the 23rd?
Yes. Oh. Yeah, as we're recording tonight.
It's out Monday the 23rd. So obviously Gary and I have had a little bit of a sneak preview, and Gary's absolutely right. It's an incredible book. And for football lovers of a certain vintage, they are going to absolutely get it. Absolutely get it. So as always, you know the drill, Steve. I don't even need to ask you anything. first of all, then, it's, you know, why the Cup Winners' Cup? You know, what gave you the idea and your motivations behind it?
It's Will Sharp's fault, when push comes to shove. When we did our series last year on the glory days of the three major competitions, European competitions, the European Champions Cup, as well as the UEFA Cup and the Cup Winners Cup. And Will kind of, like, you know, gave us a big thumbs up about the Cup Winners Cup podcast, and tongue-in-cheek, part seriously, he said, you need to put a Cup Winners Cup book on your to-do list. And I thought, that's a really kind of, like, good idea, with the 20th anniversary, the end of the tournament, fast approaching. Although I was writing a completely different book at the time, which I still have to finish, yes. So I will be going back to finish another book. But, yeah, it just suddenly became this joke idea almost that turned into reality, really.
It's that's great that we can all blame Will. It was obviously plays an important part, obviously, in these football times. I think people who listen to the podcast probably don't actually appreciate how much work Will does. But clearly now, as he's now dictating who writes what and what they need to write about, he seems to have taken exactly on a new level of responsibility.
Will is now dictating and commissioning, you know, books we need to write, and it's, yeah, he's really kind of, like, he's flying at the minute as well. He's flying.
So obviously, you know, like you said, we did do like a little trilogy of episodes about UEFA's three main competitions. Overview of the book for us, obviously, you know, because it's really important, you know, people who are listening, you know, like we say, you know, all the books that we review, all the authors we have on, you know, they're books that we go through and we think the listeners would really like. But obviously, it's really important to give them an idea of what this book is about. So, yes, we've done a Cup Winners' Cup podcast, but if you can give us sort of an overview about the book and probably its structure a little bit and you know, and how it reads.
Yeah, it's a homage, really. It's not, you know, a traditional history of a tournament. There's plenty of history in there, but it's my take on it, basically. It's historical, but it's also opinion, you know, and it's I've gone for the retrospective nature of it, you know, that feeling of being a kid and those glory days of kind of like the 70s and the 80s and you know, the era of sports nights and midweek sports special and those epic theme tunes and, you know, listening to games on the radio of an evening, Radio 2 or, you know, your local stations, and then, you know, staying up and getting like a late night, for, you know, on a school night to be able to watch highlights of games. And they were just brilliant, brilliant years. And the book's almost been an organic experience, never set out with any kind of preordained tactics. And it just tended to it just wound its own way from start to finish. It's bizarre to say it, but it just fell onto the keyboard, basically. You know, we all know we can write articles sometimes, and some articles are really hard won, you know, that you think that they should be an easy topic, yet it becomes an act of endurance almost, whereas some other articles you can just trip off. They just trip off the tongue, you know, trip off the tips of the fingers. And that was what this book did. It from start to finish, it was almost like it was meant to be written, and it really just fell onto the screen. And the way that I did it, you know, to not go in a chronological manner, even that was something that happened by accident. It was a case of the thing about the Cup Winners' Cup for me was that epic 80-81 season where Newport got to the quarterfinals. It was Dean Motobolisi, Carl Zeciana in the final, and these are the two teams that, you know, are on the front cover of the book, and it went from there. So I had to go 80-81, and from 80-81 then it made sense to do a chapter on the Eastern Bloc teams and behind the Iron Curtain. And once I did that, then it just became clear that it had to go geographical, so it just went in almost like a dot-to-dot nature.
Gary, you know, like I say, you and I have read the book, and, you know, I was sort of, you know, thinking about what was already out there about the Cup Winners' Cup, and Stephen gets this across really well, and obviously in the title as well, the randomness of it, but it is almost a tournament like no other, and Stephen is sort of, you know, and the book captures the randomness of that particular competition in the way that he's gone about writing it.
Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, the Cup Winners' Cup tournament is nothing like the European Cup stroke Champions League or UEFA Cup stroke Europa League, in as much as league position aren't defined, don't define who wins it. Anybody can win a cup competition. You know, you look back in English football, you know, Wimbledon, you know, lots of different clubs who would never have competed in European football. And, you know, Steve mentioned a few moments ago about Newport County, and Wrexham have been in there as well, Cardiff City. But teams from all parts of Europe that would never have qualified for European competition without the Cup Winners' Cup. And if there's a guy to write about the randomness and of this competition, Steve's the guy. Steve's the guy. And it captures the... I'm trying to avoid the word randomness too many times, but there's something magical about that, because it's, you know, it's not about the most consistent teams. It's about the teams that sometimes reach out and touch the sky. And different clubs across Europe, and Steve mentions them all across the... Magdeburg's a great example. It's about a Minnow's Glory, you know, where teams can play in a European competition and win a European trophy where they wouldn't qualify through a league process. So there's a wonderful free thinking opportunity for clubs to, I say, reach out into the sky. And I say, Steve captures magnificently in his book.
I know we sort of go back to the three podcasts and stuff, and I suppose to you, Stephen, obviously, you know, Will's put the idea out there as sort of almost, you know, as a semi-joke, if you like. But in terms of your own personal relationship, if you like, with the Cup Winners' Cup, because, I mean, you know, as much as you talk about it falling straight onto the keyboard, straight onto the screen, to write a book about a subject, you've got to be invested in your subject. So in terms of the Cup Winners' Cup, I suppose, what was your relationship with that particular tournament?
Well, that's the thing, you know, my team never won it. It was the one European trophy that they didn't win. They got to the final in 66. You know, I saw them get to the semi-final in 97. And it was just one that eluded us. But within that, it was great because, you know, we won the UEFA Cup. I saw us win the European Cup over and over again. So this tournament, this European tournament that we had no kind of like part in, basically, but these great stories seem to happen in. And like you say, it is that random nature to them, no rhyme or reason sometimes. And you don't get, you know, whereas league titles can be won on multiple occasions by one particular or two particular teams, you know, you don't get dynastic natures in domestic cup competitions. There's much more of a random generator to them. So the teams that went into them the following season were rarely the same as the season before. You could get kind of like, you know, the usual suspects in the European Cup. You would have usual suspects in the UEFA Cup. The Cup Winners' Cup wasn't like that. So, you know, you had a team like Ajax, for instance. They only played in it about four times, and they never played in it between 1962 and 1982. So, you know, you would have these big, big teams that would just be out of it for long periods of times and then tip up for kind of like a season every once in a blue moon. I just found great beauty in it. And the fact that it felt like someone else's, but it was such a great competition to watch without having to have that fear involved in it, because there was a great fear to European football. There was a great joy in it, but there was that panic that you were going to go out and be beaten. You know, and it really did. As a Liverpool fan, it was one of the biggest fears of the season, being knocked out of European competition. So I could enjoy this European competition just as a general football fan. And I think that's where I found, you know, my love of football away from just Liverpool. I'm a Liverpool supporter, but I'm a football fan in general. And the Cup Winners' Cup was probably the prime start of that.
I mean, you know, we've talked about this before, and it's certainly for me growing up, you know, and you're right, you know, you talk about the usual suspects in the European Cup and the UEFA Cup, but my geographical knowledge, for what it's worth, very much comes from European football. And then from there, it comes from entrance into the Cup Winners' Cup, because, like you said, that tournament, unlike any other, took football fans, and certainly us as English football fans, to places, you know, we'd never heard of and probably only ever saw and witnessed probably once in our sort of childhood watching the game. You know, we probably only ever visited there once, and yet it was a place name or a team that sticks with me even now. You know, people say, oh, your geographical knowledge is really good. It's like, yeah, but only if they've got a football team who's played in any UEFA competition, is it any good? You know, if they didn't do very well in Europe, chances are I've no idea where they are. I mean, Gary, your relationship with the Cup Winners' Cup, obviously your team have won it.
Yes.
Unlike Stevens. So I suppose, you know, Stevens talked about his relationship with his team, and I suppose, you know, conversely, your relationship as a Chelsea fan with the Cup Winners' Cup, you know, how did you perceive it?
Well, I guess there's not many tournaments that in European competition that Chelsea have won and Liverpool haven't, so I'll take that. I think actually Chelsea are one of only three teams to have won all three European competitions, and I think the other two are Juventus and Ajax, and I'll be happy to be corrected about that. But so go back to your question, though. The sort of major thing I have with the Cup Winners' Cup was the 1971 tournament. Chelsea won the FA Cup in 1970, and then obviously qualified. It was their debut year in European competition the following year when they played in the Cup Winners' Cup tournament and beat Real Madrid in the final. And, you know, I'd be sort of, where are we, so 71, I'd be 15 at the time, 15, 16 at the time. And to play in Europe was a bit sort of exotic. And to win the tournament and our debut season playing it was even better. And to beat a team like Real Madrid, talk about the icing on the cake with the cherry on the top, you know, was special. And the European Cup Winners' Cup gave Chelsea a chance to play in a European competition where we could actually succeed. You know, we were okay. We were a top seven side. You know, this we're talking about the days of Peter Osgood, Charlie Cook, Peter Harrisman, Johnny Hollins, Peter Bonetti, Chopper Harris. So we were okay in the league, but we were never going to win the league. And the Cup Winners' Cup gave us that chance. And I'm back to that randomness, that opportunity that for a lesser club. And Chelsea were a lesser club in those days. We weren't challenging for the title to play in a European competition. And it was fantastic to experience that. I mean, won it again, I'm not sure what the year was, but many years after with Vialli and Gianfranco Zola, and it was different, but it wasn't as good as that first time we won it, because that was just a bit magical.
I can only take yours to word for what it feels like to win a European competition. I'm sure it's brilliant. I'm sure all of the things that you describe are exactly how it is to be a fan of such lofty achievements. Obviously, Stephen, you know, you run with us all the time. You know, we speak to a lot of authors, and you know, we're very much, about the book and da da da. But obviously, as you're on, I feel like we can take a little bit of liberty and ask some slightly diverse questions. like I said right at the beginning, when I started reading it, and I got through the opening chapter, like you say, about the 1881, which is great, and then we break into these geographical regions, but within probably the first 30 pages, all I could think about is how much football... Well, first of all, how much detail is in the book, how much detail there is of every tournament, right down to minute detail of games, what seem like incidental incidents within a game. I'm interested in the level of research or your research process that goes into writing about a tournament in its entirety from start to finish.
Well,
and how you kept your marriage and how you kept your relationship together as well, because clearly if I watched that much football, mine would be in trouble.
Oh, I'm blessed by being married to someone who quite likes football herself as well. So
yeah,
it's never too much of a problem for me to be able to sit there and watch a game of football, whether that's kind of like happening now or something that happened 35 years ago. So, you know, that's never a problem at my house, happily. But yeah, I think it's just the way my mind works, really. It's just that, you know, I tend to focus on... I mean, I can't say I've ever been a tactical writer, but if I come to look at what I do, which isn't easy to do anyway, I'd probably say I do kind of like focus on little incidentals here and there. Almost, it might be to to almost put the reader within that perspective and to take them right within what's happening or something that's happened that makes it feel real almost. And like I say, I can honestly say it's never been a deliberate thing. I just tend to write the way that I would like to read something in a way, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
It is completely organic. I'm not I'm not a tactical writer. I'm not orthodox by any means. As far as kind of like the research goes, I love the research as much as the writing. So, you know, if I'm writing about a game or a person, then, you know, I'll go on to kind of like online archives and read articles that were in the newspapers a day or two, you know, in the build-up to a game. You know, I'll read the match reports and the post-match days and the repercussions of things. And then I'll sit and watch footage. You know, I'll happily sit and watch a game in full, or, you know, sizable highlights. And it's I tend to look for, because everyone tends to know, certainly if it's a well-known game, the major incidents. So if you can add something that's been forgotten, then that's something I'll do. Because, you know, if you're talking about the 1986 European World Cup quarterfinal, England Argentina, everyone knows, you know, the raw bones, but it's things like, you know, people forget that the Argentinian players took bunches of flowers onto the pitch for the England players prior to kickoff, you know, in a bid to disarm, you know, a potentially volatile game and atmosphere. So, you know, I'll always look for the things that are kind of like forgotten but have some sort of meaning and has a bearing on the wider picture.
I mean, Gary, like I say, you know, we've read the book, and the way Stephen's mentioned it there, and it is the incidentals within this book that make this book, you know, what it is. And he's absolutely right. You know, when you talk about the major points of games, or, you know, the points that everybody knows.
You don't necessarily have to tell people about those, because if someone's got to pick up a book. Fair enough. You know, the 1981 Cup Winners' Cup final is a different matter. But if it's kind of like, like Everton, you know, in 85, or Manchester United in 91, where Mark Hughes scored that goal from the angle, you know, people will remember stuff like that. But people might not necessarily remember that, Sergio Busquets' dad played in goal that night, you know, because Zubizarreta was suspended. It's the little oddities and the little odd ingredients that, you know, go forgotten that I try to bring back to life.
And it works, doesn't it, Gary? You know, it absolutely works.
It absolutely does. And, you know, whoever buys this book, and I recommend everybody to buy this book, you know, you need to appreciate the amount of work that goes into these things. And, from my own experience, you know, from writing my book about the World Cup, I know, you know, the games you have to watch and sort of sit there, you know, and Steve says about his, you know, his Mrs. Bev being very tolerant, and, you know, I absolutely understand, because you could not do it otherwise. You just simply could not do it. But, you know, Steve picks out the things that other people miss in this book, and it's fascinating for that. And it's important that the things that people, you know, as Steve said about the bones of the game, and, you know, everybody knows who scored the game because you look goals, you look it up. But the key moments, and about Busquets' dad, I remember Steve mentioned that in the book, and I never knew Busquets' dad. He was playing goals for Barcelona as a reserve goalkeeper. You know, who the hell knew that? Well, I tell you, did know that. Steve knew that and he wrote his book. Because that's the sort of detail this guy goes into, and the book is full of those sort of little snippets of not wisdom, but snippets of entertainment and information that sort of give a depth to the colour of the game.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Gary. It and I suppose that, you know, Steve has mentioned it puts layers on top of what people know, have a hazy memory of, think they can remember through their childhood. It's almost, it makes it such a rich rich discussion, I suppose, you know, about this tournament that was so, again, incredibly random. I'm just, before we sort of move on to the next one, one question I do have. So obviously, like you say, and I've done this so many times, like you say, even just writing articles, let alone an entire book. So when you write it, and we'll talk about the geographical breakdown in a little while, but so when you pick a thread and you find a thread, how difficult was it to stay on the thread without being pulled away to another one? Or if there was another one, was it just noted down to be returned to? Because how you balance them all, I'm not sure how you would manage that.
With each chapter, I think what I did for this was that I came up with the chapter lists and the topics. So as soon as I realised it was going in a geographical manner, then I did the headers of the names of the chapters. And then if there was something that sprang to mind or something that I came across in the research that I didn't realise or had forgotten or whatever it was, I'd just go to that chapter and just add a note that I could go back to. So it worked really well because you could be researching one game and because everyone crosses each other's path. So, you know, you would find, you know, the brilliant, I mean, the great incidentals is when you're looking at an online newspaper, an archive, and you will open up a page from, you know, a match report from the 1960s somewhere. But then something will catch your eye about kind of like a completely different match because it was played the same, you know, the night before. So it won't be the thing that you're looking for. And it's that rabbit hole, you know, situation. So you might be writing about something, but then something else catches your eye and then you need to know. So it's almost like a domino effect. And then it does it. It comes back on itself. But, you know, I always came back to where I was. So, but yeah, I could lose myself for a couple of hours at a time. You know, it was just epic stuff, like the Celtic stuff. You know, I had no idea about that Celtic semi-final in the 60s where they blew a 3-0 first leg lead to go out 4-3 on aggregate, you know, against MTK, you know, and reading the match report was just, because I was looking at that time, I was looking for... completely different matches, and I just stumbled across this match report and thought, how did they manage to throw that away? And then you come to look up the footage of the games and the goals, and you know, they were there, and it's kind of like, but it was great. It was like understanding how it happened, and then you're just piecing it together, thinking, right, you're 2-0 down there, that's where you've got to stop, kind of like ploughing forward. But no, they continue to plough forward in that gung-ho British manner of the 1960s, and it was just, and then you'd think, I'm meant to be writing about something else, but this is a bit too hypnotic to turn away from. But it all balanced out. You know, it would all balance out in the end.
I mean, Gary, you know, you've also written, obviously you've written a book as well. So, you know, I suppose, you know, your book is, you know, is about the England team and the sort of journey from, you know, of England's performances in World Cups. You know, can you relate to, I suppose, Stephen's methodology, if you like, all that almost stumbling across things by accident or picking a thread that you have to go, you can't leave alone, so you have to go back to it. Is it something you recognise?
I absolutely do. And although mine was sort of, because it was about tournaments and the World Cup, it was strictly chronological. But, you know, Stevie's is slightly different because he picks up the geographical traits of the competition. But yes, you know, you see a theme, and it's great to run with a theme, and it makes the reading of it so much easier, and it provokes the memories, you know, because we all have, depending on your vintage, of course, but, you know, we'll have memories of certain Cup finals, and you'll say, oh, yeah, I remember that there. Well, that's how that happened. And there's a knack to that, that, you know, Only writers of very readable books can do. Steve is one of those writers, and I'm because of my sort of age, I can remember pretty well almost going back to the beginning of the tournaments. But all those things, you know, those little details, those little themes that it picks up, those sort of parts of the game where other people may have sort of glossed over it, but when you read it again, you think, "Oh yeah, I remember that." And as you mentioned earlier, it adds layers to the interest of the tournaments, and it's one of the great qualities of the book.
And you can hear his voice as well. And obviously, people who listen regularly to the three of us, and you know, and go out and buy this, and you can hear Stephen's voice from word one.
Absolutely, Absolutely, mate. You can. It's like Steve's talking to you.
Yeah.
Because the way you write is the way he talks.
Absolutely.
The passion of the game.
And you're right. It takes a real talent to be able to get it across like someone is. I suppose it's a bit like the audio. Oh, the audio book. Have you been approached for an audio version?
That's the third time I've been asked now, so that's going to be my next question.
Brilliant!
To the publisher and see what they come back with.
I can just imagine that. Anyway, sorry, I got sidetracked there with that. So the book opens up. You know, we've mentioned it already. This 80-81 Cup Winners' Cup final, and it's I suppose almost chronologically it sits almost not quite in the centre of the tournament's sort of history, if you like. But it seems, you know, at first glance, it seems a very strange place to sort of start the book, and yet it absolutely works. But why? Why did you pick one particular tournament to open up this whole sort of topic, this whole history of a tournament with one particular campaign?
I just think it's the most random of all of the Cup Winners' Cup campaigns. You know, it didn't get any more random. In a very random tournament, it didn't get any more random than that particular season. You know, West Ham were England's representative, you know, a very strong West Ham side, but they were in the second division, the third successive season of playing in the second division. They won the FA Cup as a second division side in 1980. And then into the Cup Winners' Cup they went in a dominant promotion season. They only lost four league games all season in winning promotion in 80-81, got to the League Cup final. Yet, I think it was like a week and a half before playing Liverpool at Wembley in the League Cup final. They were played against Dinamo Tbilisi in the quarterfinals of the Cup Winners' Cup. And at some part, they were absolutely taken apart. They were surgically taken apart by this most hypnotic of all Soviet sides. One of my very early memories of Liverpool in Europe was Liverpool being taken apart by the very same team in the European Cup the previous season. And they were just clinical. They were the stereotypical crack Eastern European outfit, as David Coleman would always call them on Sportsnight. And that was Dinamo Tbilisi. And there was a great hidden team, basically. There's a generation of people just don't know anything about them. And they were just this fast, skillful, and ruthless side that, you know, could have won so many more European trophies, and yet it seemed the perfect place to start it. You know, West Ham played Casilla, the Real Madrid reserve side, earlier on in the competition. They'd gone to the Bernabeu to play them because Casilla had reached the 1980 Copa del Rey final, where they played Real Madrid, got stuffed 6-0 in the final, but because Real Madrid won the league title, it meant that Castilla, the Real Madrid reserve side, went into the Cup Winners' Cup the following season. West Ham drew them, lost in Madrid in a game that West Ham dominated in the first half, but they contrived to lose 3-1. There was crowd disturbances. West Ham fan was killed, hit by a bus or a coach outside the ground after the match. And UEFA went big on the sanctions that they were going to ban them, they were going to kick them out of the tournament. And then those threats were reduced to playing games, the next two games, like away from Upton Park. And this had happened to Manchester United in 77-78 when they'd had disturbances in France against Saint-Étienne. And they ended up having to play at Plymouth Argyle's home park in the return. Like, there was an exclusion zone around the home stadium by a certain mileage. And they just had to pick a, you know, find a ground that would host the game. And the same thing was going to happen to West Ham, and it was going to take the game, you know, Sunderland off to the Roker Park, for instance. But an agreement was eventually met that they could play at Upton Park, but behind closed doors. So this memory of West Ham playing this European game in an empty stadium had just forever lodged in my mind. You know, I well remembered it. I remember watching it on Midweek Sports Special. Martin Tyler was the commentator. And that bizarre, eerie kind of non-atmosphere, and that there was like an echoey doof of the ball that just echoed around all four empty stands, and this game just forever stayed with me.
And if I just jump in there, Stuart, before you go any further,
I remember
the Dynamo Tbilisi when they played West Ham, and they were an amazing side, and you know, as Steve's mentioned it. And I remember when I read that part of the book, that, you know, it brought back the memory of how they played. I can't remember the guy's name. I want to say he's Shevadze, but I might be wrong here. But he's about to stay the sweeper. He was brilliant. This guy was magnificent. He was as good a sweeper as, I don't know, perhaps. I'm exaggerated by saying he's as good as Baresi
He was a wondrous player.
He was strode out of defence with the ball, and you know, and I'm not forgotten about that. And you know, as I say, it's one of the delights of Steve's book. It brings back those memories of games like that and performances like that of teams that would otherwise perhaps never become known to the wider European audience, except for the European Cup Winners' Cup.
You're right. You know, I mean, it's almost like it. You know, we've talked about bringing a new knowledge of football that's actually old knowledge, but to a new generation of, you know, of youngsters who either have never heard of these teams or, you know, have no comprehension of the talent that was, you know, behind the Eastern Bloc in terms of, you know, the talented sides and, you know, the teams that they could consistently produce, but would only ever turn up. We would only ever see them four or five times a year if they got through to the final. You know, they'd sort of pop out from behind the Iron Curtain, play, and then disappear again. And you'd, what was that? You know, and you sort of wait for the next time to see. And I suppose this, you know, this particular 80-81 absolutely captures that entire, and although you go on to talk about, you know, the block party in the Eastern Bloc, but that particular season of that tournament really just, like you say, highlights the contribution that was made by the not so well known traditional teams, but were vital in the development of that competition.
Yeah, well, it was an era where players didn't get that freedom of movement, you know. So these great, hidden, you know, surprises that would just flash across the screen and then be gone, you know, until the next round, were just, you know, fantastic. And these names would just stick in the mind, like Gary said about Shevadze. You know, four of that Dynamo Tbilisi side went to the 1982 World Cup in the Soviet squad, and you know, people think about Soviet football and the wider span of it, and it's all Dynamo Kiev and the Moscows, and you know, there's so much more to Soviet football than Kiev and Moscow, and Dynamo Tbilisi were at the forefront of that, and yeah, it was just the hidden pleasures, basically, and I think I mentioned that in the book, that, you know, that English football fans of a certain generation, a certain way of thinking, will go a bit misty-eyed about their own team being knocked out of Europe by one of these types of team.
It's funny because we'll come on in a sec to, you know, sort of, you know, people who you spoke to, or, you know, memories that you looked for when, you know, as part of writing this book, but. We've mentioned it, you know, we've mentioned it already, but this decision, you know, and it seems like, you know, an important decision to go geographical rather than chronological in terms of the development. Was that purely through ease of structure, or was it something that you thought, again, I suppose, fitted the nature of the tournament and so therefore would fit the book?
Yeah, it wasn't a conscious decision. It just kind of happened that way. And I think when it came to having done the 80-81 chapter and it being so Eastern European centric, it just made sense to do an Eastern European chapter as the second chapter. And yeah, it really was just it was something that dawned, basically. And I think I've always thought that way anyway, in the way that European competition, certainly of old at the very least, and even still now, you look at the Spanish domination of recent years, there tends to be periods of dominance by certain countries or certain parts of Europe. If you look at the European Champions Cup now, Real Madrid and Benfica and the Milans dominated so early. Southern Europe were massive and Northern Europe couldn't get a look in. But then eventually along come Celtic, Manchester United, then the dawning of Feyenoord and Ajax. So Northern Europe kind of like take a stranglehold. So I do think football, European football, club football, has had a propensity to shift in a geographical nature, almost like the tectonic plates will shift things. So I think it just kind of made sense, but I couldn't understand why it made sense. But, you know, I kind of do now.
You know. Now there's the finished product.
Now it's all finished and printed. It all makes sense that it didn't quite before.
It's strange, isn't it, Gary? You and I have read it. And I suppose, you know, people hearing us sort of talk, you know, hopefully, you know, we're generating interest and people wanting to read this book, and which is absolutely right. But it's so difficult to get across, even in this chat and with the author, that the way this book is written, the structure that this book is written, is actually perfect for the tournament.
Yeah, you know, you're right, Stu. You've hit the nail on the head there, mate. And as I said earlier, you know, it's not... The Cup Winners' Cup tournament is nothing like the Champions League, the stroke European Cup, or UEFA Cup, stroke Europa League. It's entirely different, and approaching it in a different way, with the way Steve's doing it in the book, fits perfectly, because it's not about the consistency of clubs who dominated things. It's different every time. And, Steve mentioned about the sort of geographical sways and the waxing and wanings of different areas of Europe in the Cup Winners' Cup. And that's a perfect description of how it was, because you don't get the domination like Ajax winning three times, Bayern Munich winning three times, like Real Madrid winning five times in the first five tournaments, and the domination of Milan and Real Madrid of late. There's none of that. There's absolutely none of that in the Cup Winners' Cup. And so, you know, the way Steve does it absolutely captures it wonderfully, because it is, it's diverse, it's different, and it's almost wonderful in its unsophistication.
That is a great way to put it. The lack of sophistication within the tournament is actually what makes it such an appealing tournament.
Yeah.
Obviously, when one of the chapters that sort of fascinated me is Newport's relationship with the tournament as well, and the whole Welsh relationship. But with regards to, I suppose, speaking to people, and gaining opinions and memories, how receptive were fans, if you like, supporters of certain clubs, to talk to you, you know, with regards to the competition and their thoughts about the competition?
Oh, they were just delighted to talk about it. Once you got someone started, it was hard to stop them, you know, but in that best possible way, you know. And a lot of the stories, and I think I mentioned it in the final chapter, because I'm to write it from, you know, an abstract perspective, I found it difficult to bring those stories in, so I left it to the last chapter and did a chapter that kind of like dedicated on those people who I spoke to, and it was great because I managed to speak to, you know, people, supporters of, you know, Fortuna Dusseldorf, a Barcelona fan, you know, who went to the 79 final, and he eventually said that stuff came back to him that he'd long since forgotten about going to that game as like a 13, 14 year old with his dad, and travelling, you know, by road to it, and, you know, his memory of the ground and the train that goes past and stops and watches, you know, the driver stops and watches the game because of that amazing stadium in Basel, as was, where, you know, there was a train line that the train come past and it oversees the stadium, you know, and stuff like that. And it was great just hearing these kind of like stories, but it was almost similar to, you know, the podcast that me and you do, Stu, the My Side ones, and, yeah, you know, that passion of people's memories and just enjoyment of that era. And it was interesting talking to Marty, that you know, Marty Gonzalez, the Barcelona fan who has seen his team do so much in a contemporary manner since winning that first European Cup in 92. And becoming the dominant side in Spain, you know, they really have usurped Real Madrid in that respect. Yet he still looks back misty-eyed on kind of like 79 and a simpler time in football, and, you know, being a kid and just watching the game with, you know, wide-eyed, and the Cup Winners' Cup was massive to him, absolutely massive.
I mean, Gary, we, you know, we talk about this quite often, and the oral history, if you like, of competitions of football, you know, is something that we need to look after and protect, and, you know, needs to be heard. And it, you know, and it's all right, Stephen, you know, watching videos, reading newspaper articles, and, you know, the depth of research he does, but there's no substitute for actually speaking to people and recording their experiences and their memories of any element of anything, but certainly within, you know, within football in a bygone era.
Yeah, absolutely true, mate. The oral history of people who watch football is a treasure trove for people who write books. You know, I remember when going back to when we won the European Cup Winners' Cup 71. The following year, we played, I think, in the first round, a team from Luxembourg, and rattled up 21 goals, 13-0 at home, 8-0 away, and then went out in the second round. You know, you can't sort of write those sort of things. So to speak to people who have experienced those things, these magnificent occasions where their teams have been in situations where, I wouldn't say they've got no right to be, because that's very pompous, so I don't mean to be so, but they've got no expectation to be, perhaps, is a better way of putting it. You know, and the part Stevie puts in his book about Newport County is really good in that sort of context. And the oral histories were people who remember those games, and when they're playing some of the top European teams, it's important that we keep these things there, because they're precious, and it's a legacy of the Cup Winners' Cup, which is, you know, unique is a phrase that's thrown about too easily. But the Cup Winners' Cup was unique because it was entirely different to other European competitions. And people who experienced their teams playing in that competition, and I say I was one of those when we won the Cup in 1971, we beat Real Madrid. You know, it was an amazing triumph because we were never going to win the European Cup because we couldn't win the league. We were miles away from winning the league. But to have that sort of experience and to have that recorded down for posterity is a truly important thing to do.
It's funny, you know, as you were talking there, Gary, and it's, I mean, really now, you know, we now have an entire generation, if you like, you know, two decades, you know, an entire generation who have never known the Cup Winners' Cup, have never experienced it, never lived it, you know, and don't, almost don't understand, and that's not through their fault, but don't appreciate, you know, this actual tournament. When you look at the, you know, how massive the Champions League is and the Europa League, you know, we grew up with it as the European Cup and then the UEFA Cup, but this Cup Winners' Cup is like a mystery to a whole generation now.
You're absolutely right. I think the football world's poorer because of that.
I'm glad you think that, because I'm going to get all your perspectives on that and its place as we come to the end. So, yeah. I suppose next question then, Steve. Like I say, we're slightly doing this slightly differently, which I'm kind of enjoying myself, I'm not going to lie. your geographical, you know, by region is great, but then, so again, with the randomness, all of a sudden Everton and Ferguson gets their own chapters, which is quite, not jarring, yeah, but you can do it how you like. But all of a sudden, it's oh, hang on a minute. I understand how this book's going. I understand how it's working. And all of a sudden, bang, one team gets its own chapter. And then, you know, we go back to geographical, and bang, one particular manager gets his own chapter. And again, I suppose I'm just interested as to why those two.
Well, Everton, for me, there was a detachment for Everton, because we're had done this chapter on kind of like a British kind of dominance. It was dominance that ended, you know. So by the time Chelsea win in 71, then Rangers in 72, British teams start to struggle with the tournament. And West Ham reached the final in 76, Arsenal do in 1980, but it's almost like a different story has begun to be told, and they aren't really part of that era of Manchester City and Chelsea winning it, of Rangers getting to those three finals and West Ham winning it. And this second coming of West Ham and the final that Arsenal got to and lost on penalties, there is a sense of detachment from that era of British success. It's almost as if the West Ham of 76 and the Arsenal of 1980 belong to the stories of Anderlecht and Valencia instead. You know, they're a co-star in those stories. So by the time you get to Everton in 85, it's been 13 years since a British team has... about 14 years since an English side has won the tournament. Aberdeen won in 83. But again, you know, it came to looking at it and thinking, well, where do you put that within the arc of the story? But because Ferguson comes back again in 91 and wins it, I had to kind of like bracket Ferguson's achievement as something that had to stand alone. And the same was for Everton as well. You know, it was so the successes that are owned, the self-owned, they're not part of anything else. They are literally self-owned successes. You know, 83 and 91 belong to Ferguson more so than they do to Aberdeen and Manchester United somehow. You know, 85 is very much a standalone for Everton, the first English side to win it in 14 years. And then there is that what if, you know, we'll never know what that Everton side would have done in Europe. You know, and that's coming from a Liverpool supporting perspective. You know, a surmise, you know, you can take an educated guess of what might happen because of what went before. And Everton's European pedigree hadn't been great until 85, but it needed its own story. It couldn't be attached to anyone else. You know, that Everton side was absolutely outstanding. And even down to kind of like the way that they won the Cup Winners Cup in 85, the final was almost an incidental compared to what went in the semi-final against Bayern Munich. The story's all about Bayern Munich for Everton, and it's all about almost going out to UCD, University College Dublin, in the early rounds, which was very Everton, would have been an eminently Everton thing to do, because you know they did often fall out of Europe at the early stages. You know, they got to the European Cup quarterfinals in 71, lost to Panathinaikos. So, you know, this golden opportunity that was there to really go for it, and they fumbled it, and that was kind of what Everton did. So that concept of what they might have done beyond 85, maybe they would have gone and won the European Cup, but maybe they'd have just reverted to the Everton of old. You know, little known fact was that despite the ban implemented from 85-86, that Everton and Manchester United still went into the draw for the sake of balance into the European Cup and the Cup Winners' Cup. And Everton would have faced Anderlecht in the first round in the European Cup in 85-86 had they played. And it was interesting speaking to Paul Dempsey, Everton fan, who a fantastic fella, and Rick George, you know, who was Liverpool Echo correspondent for both Everton and Liverpool at various times for a long, long time, who I spoke to. And when I mentioned this to both of them, they had no recollection and no... It was a surprise to them to hear of this, you know, that they would have played Anderlecht in the first round of the next European Cup. But they did that. They just needed their own storytelling without anyone else sharing the stage, basically. So, you know, it basically came down to they had to have, you know, their own stage, as did Ferguson.
I mean, Gary, this is why the book works, isn't it? Like you've said, it defies conventions of how a book would normally, you know, the journey would travel, or you think you've got a handle on the book and how it's going to play out for the remainder of the book, and actually you have no clue. A little bit like the Cup Winners' Cup.
Yeah, but I'd just add to that as well that those were chapters that, you know, were always going to be big ones for me to write as a Liverpool fan, you know, to try and be as objective as possible about writing those chapters and being scrupulously objective. And you know, I hope, you know, and Everton and Manchester United, Aberdeen fans can tell me, you know, they can come and find me on Twitter and tell me if I did them, you know, I did them proud enough.
Yeah. Oof.
challenge laid down.
Yeah, no, I like it. It's brave, wasn't it, Gary?
Believe it was, yeah. But, you know, I think what Steve says is true, you know, there, and it's entirely valid. You know, Ferguson's success was probably justifying a chapter of its own, as was Everton's, and you know, and it's, you know, it's to Steve's eternal credit that, you know, as a Liverpool fan, he's not sort of, you know, blind to the opportunity that Everton would have, you know, perhaps have been able to take if it hadn't been for Heysel and the ban in European football. But then again, this is again another wonderful example of the magic of the Cochrane's Cup. It's a tournament, you know, that is, you know, I say unique. I've used the term a lot today, and it's because of its randomness and teams that would that sort of reached out. I say reached out and touched the sky.
Fair enough. I would very much agree with that. You know, we're already, you know, nearly at the hour, but that's fine. We're all in charge on this, and we don't have to please anyone tonight apart from ourselves. I suppose, you know, coming to favourite chaps, you know, I'll start with you, Stephen. It's your book, your thing. You can have first go tonight. Which chapter gave you the most? I'm not saying the most enjoyment in terms of writing, but gave you the most satisfaction having completed it and thought, yeah, that's, I've nailed that. I'm all over that one. That's, you know, I'm happy with how that reads.
I'd probably say the opening chapter. You know, because I mean, it's a huge thing to get that opening chapter done when you've got the thing. Because if you're writing a book like this, sometimes, you know, you can get frustrated with a chapter and step away from it to go back to complete it. But that chapter just fell straight onto the page and it set the tone for the rest of the book. And it was a, you know, that Soviet era, you know, the whole Iron Curtain and the Eastern Bloc has always fascinated me, those teams and those nations in international tournaments. And I just absolutely loved writing that. You know, without a shadow of a doubt, I absolutely adored, you know, writing that 80-81 chapter and, you know, the Eastern Bloc chapter that followed it. And I can't pick between the two.
That's right.
But it's those two.
That's all right. You can have as many choices as you want. Don't worry about it. Gary, for you, any chapter in particular that, you know, that either you enjoyed reading or brought home the Cup Winners' Cup or was something that brought back, you know, personal memories for you?
Yeah, well, I'm going to be a bit cheeky as well and take two as well, because the Eastern Bloc one, we talked about Dynamite Tbilisi earlier, and Dynamite Tbilisi is a way of playing, opened my eyes to the beauty of the sweeper system, the guy who could play it from the back and bring ball out, you know, and many players have sort of took that on, you know, and I want ball people, could be you and Steve, are Lord Baresi and Barry Hulshoff as the ideal defensive players in football ever. You know, so I would go with that, because Tbilisi definitely opened my eyes to the sweeper system and how that's a wonderful way of playing. But probably my favourite chapter was Steve's called the pre-Nouveau Riche chapter, which mentions about when Chelsea won the tournament in 71, because that was the first European triumph for my club. And, you know, going through the history of the tournament and that tournament when Steve goes through all the games, you know, I remember those things, and it brought back wonderful memories, you know, the draw and the first game, and then all the Chelsea fans had to go back home because three or four days later they played the replay, but we won the cup in the end. And now, that was a wonderful chapter to read for me, because it brought back, you know, as you say, it's all about memories of the Cup Winners' Cup, and it worked wonderfully for me.
It's funny, obviously the block party chapter is clearly the one that's going to hit home with a certain generation, Stephen. For me, you know, like you two, that it brought back, for me, it brought back the child in me. I mean, obviously your introduction about cheese on toast and, you know, midweek sports special and sports night, straight away I was there. And then as soon as we're into the block party, it's like, oh, you know, yeah, those names that I'd completely forgotten. And yet as soon as I read them, I was like, oh my God, yeah, absolutely. I remember, you know, as clear as day, although I'd forgotten about them for what is years within, you know, having read them once, it's like, yep. And the memories that it sort of triggered from my childhood, and that block party chapter does that perfectly. That's probably a lot to do with, like we said, the nature of the Cup Winners' Cup and, you know, the teams that entered it and the very random nature of teams that entered it. But I think for me, the one that I found the most fascinating was the Catalan love affair. And it's, you don't forget because we're older, but anybody who is a relatively, or is younger than us three, should I say, probably is a better way to put it, or newer to football than we are, and you look at Barcelona today and you look at the success and the glory and the dominance, and yet you read this chapter and you look at, it was almost like a torrid affair that Barcelona had with the Cup Winners' Cup, and it seemed to be the, you know, they weren't the European Cup as we know it. They, you know, they weren't the dominant side in the European Cup. You know, the Cup Winners' Cup would often, you know, be their best chance of European success, and it seemed to be almost that the Cup Winners' Cup and Barcelona seemed to have a love-hate relationship with each other, and you forget that as a football fan now for the last decade, 10, 15 years. You know, Barcelona you just associate with the latter stages of the Champions League, and you know, you read this book and you only have to go back, you know, 30, 35 years, and it's a completely different Barcelona. It's a, you know, they're completely different, almost targets that it's setting itself. Success is seen completely differently to how it is now. And for me, that chapter, it almost signifies how the game has changed, I suppose. It's, you know, it's the perfect definition of the way the game has changed. You might not have been going for that, but that's what I took from it.
No, you've nailed what I tried to do.
Brilliant.
It's the Barcelona that I remember, you know. And yeah. There was something fraudulent almost about Barcelona, the old Barcelona, was that, you know, they couldn't win the titles to save their lives almost, you know, because they went from 61 to the Don and a Cruyff and winning in 91, a 30-year span where, you know, they only won two titles in 74 and 85 under, you know, Venables. So it took Michels and then Venables to win them the titles. There was this huge drought, and the Cup Winners' Cup became so important to them because they would pick off, you know, Copa del Rey's, and they just never had that consistency to see out wins in league titles and get over that omnipresent dominance of Real Madrid. And sometimes if Real Madrid couldn't win it, then, you know, Atletico would. But then you had the early 1980s Basque period where Real Sociedad win back-to-back titles, followed by Atletico Bilbao winning back-to-back titles. And they just were constantly denied La Liga titles over and over again. And it was that concept that they felt that they were being denied by the powers that be. Yet it was as much, if not more so, denied by their own inability to put consistency together to be able to win that. But they could pick off a cup competition, and then the Cup Winners' Cup just became so important to them. And, you know, no one won it more than they did. They won it four times. They reached another two finals. You know, and there was still even that doomed kind of side about them within it, because they still lost to Slovan Bratislava in the 69 final and to Manchester United in 91. You know, one of the very, very few times that Johan Cruyff was kind of psyched out, you know, and that's part of the beauty of Ferguson's achievements in 91, is that he kind of... The mind games, the classic Ferguson mind game, basically. You know, I think it's probably the greatest example of how he used to get into the head of an opposing manager and win a game, you know, almost in a mental capacity way before the teams took to the pitch.
And like I say, it's the perfect chapter for how you bring the old game and to the present day, and the, you know, the new game. And Ferguson is very much, you know, linked to that because of the length of time that he spent at Manchester United. But like you say, you know, Ferguson's chapter, and in particular that chapter that looks at Barcelona's relationship with the tournament, and it's just everything you need to know about football from when we were growing up, and then football from today, and, you know, and how people see the game. Certainly, young people see the game today.
I was just going to say, because I bring in, you know, other Spanish teams, and the fact that, you know, you can go all the way to the final in Real Mallorca, reaching it, that the Spanish kind of influence on the tournament remained to the very end.
It is, and like you say, even Real Mallorca, even there, you know, you have this name that, you know, I suppose people who are students of La Liga will be very aware of. But in terms of Europa League, Champions League, it's not a side that is, you know, that is, you would put forward as being a representative of La Liga and Spanish football today. So, like I say, we have to end at some point, unfortunately. But obviously, still got a couple more questions, so don't worry, we're good. Writing the book, you know, the Cup Winners' Cup. Obviously, you know, you have this, you know, you have this love of the tournament. But I suppose, from before the first word goes on the page to the final word going on the page, did your perception of it, your appreciation of it, your feelings for the competition change in any way, or were they merely just reinforced through the research or the process?
Probably just reinforced, really. I mean, like I say, I love that competition simply out of the randomness of it, the fact that we weren't involved in it and you could just enjoy other people's, you know, enjoyment of European football and the torment of it as well, because that's what you get with the football. For there's only going to be one winner in the tournament, and for the Cup Winners' Cup, if it's a field of 32, then 31 teams are going to roll out disappointed. But it was those great stories and the fact that not one team ever retained the Cup Winners' Cup, you know, and that accentuates the randomness. You know, there were plenty of teams who reached a final as holders. You know, seven times teams got to the final as holders and failed to win it. But it reawoken the way that the tournament felt. And I think I mentioned that part where your part might be just part of the blurb of the book, is that how the European Cup, the Cup Winners' Cup and the UEFA Cup all had a very distinctive feelings of one another. They were all European club competitions, but they still felt that little bit different to one another. You know, the European Cup kind of glowed because, you know, you had to win your league title to be involved in it. But the fact that, you know, you're factoring in league champions from weaker leagues, it didn't always have the strongest feel, you know, but you would have at least six or seven megaliths in there that could win it. So it almost glowed, the European Cup. The UEFA Cup, I think, are classed as being where the cool kids often hung out, because you had three, four, sometimes, teams from each nation. So you would have, you know, you'd have like 25 massive teams, all of whom were, you know, capable of winning it. And then you would get a surprise coming through, like an IFK Gothenburg, who would take everyone by surprise. But then the Cup Winners' Cup just felt completely different again. So they were almost like three individual siblings. We all have kids and they all have that different temperament and that different personality. And it's kind of how the European competitions felt, and doing this book. And it reminded me of how the Cup Winners' Cup felt, because the European competitions now, the Champions League and the Europa League, don't feel anything like the competitions that went before them.
I mean, it's great. It's like we work together a lot, us three. from there, Gary, I suppose the question is the legacy of the Cup Winners' Cup. You know, I mean, what, you know, we've talked about Stevens, but we've talked about the tournament on and off. We've talked about the random nature of it. We've talked about, you know, its contribution to football, its contribution to people growing up, people's, you know, finding, you know, almost a love affair with, you know, with football could almost be through that tournament and through teams. And certainly my GCSE geography knowledge comes from the Cup Winners' Cup. But in terms of its legacy, where do you see its legacy, Gary?
That's a really difficult question, Stu, because I don't think either of the tournaments that are played in Europe now are anything like the Cup Winners' Cup. They don't have the randomness, they don't have the ability to surprise, they don't have the magnificence of the Cup Winners' Cup, because you can't pick the winners, but you can probably pick, before the tournament starts, you can probably pick six teams, and you're gonna pick one of those six teams, you're gonna win it. In the Cup Winners' Cup, that never applied, because there was so much difference between the teams, that, and nobody knew of these teams, especially for the Eastern European teams. So I think the legacy of the Cup Winners' Cup is almost locked into the past. It's certainly not been honoured by European football, by UEFA, because they've taken that away, and probably it's been sacrificed on the altar of money, and giving the big clubs the dependency on regular games where they're going to pick up lots of brass by playing group. The Companies Cup was different and remains that. And I think its legacy is that it was entirely different. It existed in its own world, and clubs that would never qualify for Champions League or Europa League or UEFA Cup Champions League, whatever you call the tournaments these days, had a chance of playing European football. And that's gone now.
It feels like such a sad ending.
I think it is. And I think Steve's book is a magnificent tribute to it. And it does give a legacy, and it reminds people of what's gone and what isn't there anymore.
It is just like we work together all the time. Because my final, final question, obviously to you, Stephen, is, I know, and Gary's just mentioned it, the money and your way from the way competition structure, and I'm fully aware of what the fact that we'll probably never see it again. But my question to you, I suppose, is there a place, or should there be a place for the Cup Winners' Cup within the modern day game? That's a better question. Should there be a place for the Cup Winners' Cup in the modern game?
In my opinion, they should return it to what it used to be, but they're never going to do that. And I think the problem for a Cup Winners' Cup now is that the vast majority of teams that would win the domestic cup would also finish in the top three or four in the domestic league, thus gain entry to the Champions League, and they would forsake a chance at playing in the Cup Winners' Cup. So it's probably an unworkable situation to be able to bring it back. I think the only way something like that, and I've mentioned before about European Super League, for instance, if that happened and it cherry picked the big 20 teams and cocooned them off into their own no relegation tournament, and then everyone else was just left with football and a blank piece of paper, then yes, bring back the European competitions as was, have this Super League inhabited by the great and the greedy by all means, but then let football kind of regenerate itself further down and have a European Champions Cup, have a UEFA Cup, have a Cup Winners' Cup.
Brilliant. Gary, any final words for Stephen's book?
Yeah, I would say to anybody who likes football, who sort of relishes the history of football and its traditional values, go and buy the book. Go out and buy the book. It's a fantastic read. Steve's a great writer, and he tells a story with great empathy and passion. Go and buy the book.
It's a tournament frozen in time, which is the title, but it's the subtitle, the wonderful randomness of the European Cup Winners' Cup. And I think right there sums up Stephen's writing, it sums up his approach to the book, it sums up the tournament, it sums up the subject matter, it almost sums up, and this is in no way, it sums up the structure of the book and the way it's written. It's almost like they're just made for each other. The author, the tournament, and the book as a trilogy come together in what it can only be described as a perfect retelling of a tournament that very much still should and does have its place in football history. And that's probably the greatest compliment I can pay you, Stephen.
Oh, guys, you need to be my ad agency.
So I know I'm going to put you on the spot here, and I apologise for that. Is there going to be a copy on offer for a lucky winner once this podcast goes out?
Yeah, I've just given one away this very, very evening, but there will be another one to go along with the podcast as well.
Brilliant. Well, Stephen, thank you very much for joining us on the other side of the desk. It was great to chat to you in a different capacity, I've got to say.
I know, it's weird. I now know how the guests feel coming on talking about their own stuff. It's frightening.
Gary, thanks for not leaving me on my own. I am really grateful. But at least one of my friends is still here.
Yeah, I enjoyed reading the book, and, you know, it's great talking with Stevie about it. You know, it's, I'll just say it again, you know, it's a great book. Go and buy the book, for God's sake, guys. Go and buy the books.
Yeah, because only one person can win one, so everyone else is going to have to buy one. All that's left is for me to thank the listeners, and please join us again next time on the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.